Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hills, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook with a special broadcast of On Point from the Online News Association Conference going on this week in Boston. It is the world's largest membership organization of digital journalists, and this hour we will hear from some of them. To our listeners around the country and here at the conference, welcome. Journalism is in a new era. It's all around us right here. Call it the crowdsourcing era, where a cell phone photo can land on the front page, where citizens shoot footage for cable news, where one text message or Facebook post or 10,000 from Syria or Tahrir Square or the path of an American hurricane can help paint the big picture of what's happening. It is happening right now, this hour on Point. Crowdsourcing and the future of journalism. You can join the conversation. Can a crowd bring us the news? An important piece of it, a new piece of it. What's the potential you see? The pitfalls, the reality right now. You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us here at the table today is Mandy Jenkins. She is the social news editor at the Huffington Post, where she heads up crowdsourcing. Mandy Jenkins, welcome to On Point. Great to have you.
Hey, great to be here.
Also with us is Robert Hernandez, professor at the University of Southern California's Annenberg School of Communications and Journalism, where he studies the intersection of technology and journalism. Robert Hernandez, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And joining us from Washington on his way to the conference is Derek Ashong, the host of The Stream. It's a daily show on Al Jazeera Television that uses a lot of social media to report the news. Derek Ashong, welcome to you as well.
Thanks, Tom. Great to be with you.
We're going to look at a lot of what's going on. This is, of course, it's about the future, but by no means only the future. We are well into the crowdsourcing era. Here's some sound from April. Syrians, that is, in Syria, demonstrating in large numbers against the Assad regime there. There were so many amateur videos posted online and used by news organizations to tell the story of what was happening when they couldn't get in. Here, Al Jazeera reporter Stephanie Decker uses amateur footage of street clashes between protesters and government forces.
The picture that's been emerging on the internet from within Syria tells a story of mass protests, shootings, and killings. We'll let them speak for themselves.
We'll let them speak for themselves. And what's speaking there is not a microphone held by a news reporter. It's someone in Syria who puts it out to the world. It can be incredibly affecting. In June 2009, protests erupted in Iran. With few Western journalists in the country, one of the most iconic reports of events there was a close-up video, apparently shot on a cell phone camera, of an Iranian, young Iranian woman named Neda Agha Sultan dying in the street of a gunshot wound. With the cell phone camera, tragically, on that beautiful, dying young woman on her face, bystanders scream there as Neda silently bleeds to death on a street in Tehran. The networks aired the footage, and it was viewed millions of times on YouTube. Later that year, that video won a George Polk Award for videography. Derek Ashong, this is by no means in the future. Crowdsourcing is happening right now.
Absolutely. And one of the things that I think is so important about it is it's changing the way we think about media. Historically, media has been almost an elite profession in the sense that that fourth estate has the opportunity to shape public opinion and what information is deemed to be important. But in the modern era, people are able to actually capture content, create content, show what's happening in their communities. And if enough people are then able to access it, they can shift our perception of what's important and therefore what traditional journalists will also report on.
Robert Hernandez, it's such a big term, crowdsourcing. What are the elements of it? What's included in crowdsourcing these days? How wide is the range, the universe?
Well, when I crowdsourced folks on Twitter to get points to talk about here, someone asked me, does it include funding? Kickstarter.com is something that funds projects. There's
what kind of news projects?
All types of startups. $75 million have been raised by the community to fund all types of projects, including Diaspora, which is a Facebook competitor. But
let's narrow the range right there. Personally, as a news guy, in this conversation, I don't care that much about that. They're funding startups, great. But when it comes to news, I mean, that's why I really want to focus on crowdsourcing and what's available there. We just now heard. What footage and sound coming out of Syria, coming out of Iran? It's come out of the United States in many circumstances. And when it comes to news, what are the elements that flow into crowdsourcing?
Well, there are a lot of things to look at, and it's really harnessing the wisdom of the crowd. And the technology that we have now really empowers that in ways that have never been done before. But it's not something necessarily new, in my opinion. Think of the Kennedy assassination. What is the footage that we think of? Was it footage from the news? It was a Zapruder film.
Right.
And now amplify that with cell phones and microphones and apps that do everything. And therefore, the flow of information is coming in. The role of a journalist is to collect that, to aggregate that, to harness the power of the crowd, to select the things to be retweeted, to share, distributed, verified. Journalism is still very much about verifying sources and facts and then telling a narrative.
Mandy, obviously, it's not absolutely new. Look at Kennedy. Kennedy 1, Kennedy 2, Bobby Kennedy, and the footage that told us about those things. But as Robert says, the amplification here is gigantic. Nearly everybody has a cell phone now. Everybody has, or many millions have Twitter accounts and Facebook accounts and all the rest. How do you look at the range of streams that flow into news-related crowdsourcing?
I mean, the streams are pretty much unlimited between Twitter and Facebook, YouTube, text messaging that's still going very wide. I mean, there's just so many people out there that at one time they might have witnessed something or been a part of something and maybe sent an email to somebody or sent a text message to a friend, but now they can amplify that to a huge degree, just one person, by the people they're connected to and the people that they're connected to. So, as Robert said, it's important for journalists to get in there and say, you know, this is right, this isn't right, harnessing the crowd to help make sure that we're getting the right information out to that larger amplification.
And it's not just the assassination of a president anymore. It can come right down to much smaller events, but that people look at and they take on a great import of their own. Here, 2009, police officers in San Francisco detained Oscar Grant as he was sitting on the floor of a train station in San Francisco. Crowd gathered. Some people began filming the action, cameras everywhere. Seconds later, one of those officers drew his gun and shot Grant in the back. Cell phones caught that moment. There you are, front row seat, and it's not the assassination of a president. Grant died. The video went viral. It sparked days of violent demonstrations against police brutality. The impact of crowdsourced news can be enormous. Derek Ashong, this has been especially true this year in the Arab world with the Arab Spring, one arena after another where there's been absolutely a central role.
Oh, it has been massive in the Arab Spring, and one of the things that you saw with many of the governments in the Arab world was the efforts to shut down the internet, which is a primary method of disseminating information. You've seen it efforts in Egypt. You saw it in Tunisia. You also in Syria see something different where you actually have what some allege to be pro-government organizations or government-affiliated organizations actually hacking and defacing the websites of organizers. One thing that's important to point out, though, particularly since you raised the issue of Oscar Grant, is that it's not not simply overseas where they're considering trying to shut down methods of communication, but just within the last month, we actually saw a similar effort being attempted by the BART, the Bay Area Rapid Transport, in order with BART police who actually, one of them killed Oscar Grant, tried to shut down the usage of cell phones on the platforms because they didn't want protest video to get out while people were protesting. So one of the things that I think is so important to think about, even as journalists in the United States, is that just as these tools can empower people around the world, so can they be abrogated. And that effort to try to silence not simply the voices, but the means of disseminating those voices is also taking place here in our own country.
We'll look at restraints and how those might work, even when you're talking about millions of people. But Derek, just in your own case, on the stream, you're pulling from all kinds of crowdsourced sources. Like what? How do you use the dynamic of crowdsourcing?
Great question, Tom. So what we do is we're trying to build a program that is fully integrated between broadcast and social media. So we crowdsource on a number of different levels. You have the traditional element that people think of when they think of like using new media and tweets and things like that, which is that we have interactivity during the show. People can tweet at us, they can send us Facebook notes, they can actually ask questions of our guests while we're live on the air. But the other thing that we do that I think is really special and important is we actually crowdsource our stories from our community. So a significant number of the stories that we'll cover, for example, yesterday we did a piece on Bahrain and what's going on with political tensions, ongoing tensions there. And it was a story that we did because our audience was saying, we want to talk about this. This is what's happening. This is the latest. Let's cover it. Let's cover it. Let's cover it. And not only that, but we actually use tools which we train our audience to also use such that they can create their own stories and submit to us. So we use crowdsourcing on a number of levels, and it increases the relationship between us and our audience.
You're on the air, Derek. A tweet comes in and makes some amazing claim. You put it on the air. How do you know? I mean, we're going to look more at this, but how do you know it's true when you're crowdsourcing in that way?
This is one of the challenges of living on the bleeding edge of digital media, I would say, because we don't want to misinform our viewers. And so what we do typically is if a tweet comes in and it makes a strong statement or allegation, we will present it to the guest whom we're interviewing on the ground in that area and give them a chance to respond.
Of course, it's already on the air. Derek, hold the thought right there. We've got to take a short break right here. Derek Ashong with Al Jazeera. Please stand by. Mandy Jenkins with the Huffington Post. Robert Hernandez from University of Southern California. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is a special broadcast of On Point from the big annual Online News Association conference this week in Boston. There are more than 1,000 journalists here from around the country and the world. For those with us today, welcome and thanks for being here. We're talking this hour about something very important in this setting and right around the world today, crowdsourcing and the future, the present of news. Derek Ashong is with us from Al Jazeera English, host of The Stream there, a show that aggregates online sources and discussion while seeking out unheard voices for new perspectives from people on the ground. Crowdsourcing. Mandy Jenkins is with us, social news editor for The Huffington Post, formerly social media editor at TBD, local news site owned by Politico. And with me here in Boston, Robert Hernandez, assistant professor of professional practice, University of Southern California's Annenberg School of Communication and Journalism. Let's go straight to our crowdsource. It's talk radio after all. Scott's calling from Chesapeake, Virginia. Scott, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you for having me. My main comment is that while you can have a member of the crowd on the scene immediately, they're not necessarily going to hold themselves to the same journalistic code of ethics. So you have to take into account the lack of accountability that the crowd has, and the journalists themselves that are conveying this to the public need to be acting as a strong gatekeeper.
It's a great point. Let me put it to the panel. We've got much the same from others online. Richard writes, crowdsourcing for tips and leads is one thing, but crowdsourcing for opinion is a disaster. News and opinion needs to be digested through human beings who can't be bought or gamed. I hope journalists fit that category, but so far it's tough to find people who don't have a price. What about to our listener online, to our caller? Robert, I mean, let me come to you first. People seem very open to hearing from fellow citizens about what's happening, but if we're looking at this as news, how do we know that it passes that bar of credibility, of accuracy?
Well, I don't agree that I don't believe the crowd is going to replace journalism, but it's definitely enhancing journalism. As eyewitnesses and potential sources, those tips come in, like a tip in email or over the phone or face-to-face. The role of the journalist is to verify. Reporting isn't done when the tweet comes out. Reporting begins when the tweet goes out. And the reporter goes out and collects them. And it's the crowd that enhances the coverage, our eyewitnesses that hold each other accountable. Mandy and I saw this on September 1st when a gunman walked into the Discovery Channel headquarters last year. And I was in Los Angeles when that was happening in my office and monitoring tweets and Foursquare and watching the news break and finding local sources. There were eyewitnesses to that.
People were tweeting from inside the Discovery Channel.
Employees of the Discovery Channel. Of course, the crowd is making a wide variety of claims. I saw this. I heard this. And I'm monitoring it in Los Angeles, tweeting about it, telling journalists to follow it, following tweets per the zip code of where the building was located. And I saw self-correcting. You know, there was a photo that was tweeted around saying, like, is this the gunman? But the crowd then corrected it and said, no, it wasn't. So it was a really great example of it. And Mandy, you were on the recovering it as well.
What about Mandy? How does that work? And how do you know when you can pick one tweet out of the huge flow of tweets, let's say, just to take one and broadcast that and put that out on Huffington Post or anywhere else? Does it balance out?
Well, actually, the situation that Robert was talking about is a perfect example because I was working at TBD doing local news when that happened, and that was a local story for us. And I'm sitting at my desk talking to eyewitnesses that are on the scene. The whole area is shut down. I mean, we couldn't get reporters in there. We couldn't get anywhere near there. But there were people that were locked down in the buildings all the way around the crime scene, shooting live video, shooting photos, sending them our way. You know, we're able to back those up by saying, yeah, this is definitely from this angle, looking at it on Google Maps. We can verify that these are from the scene. They're taken right there. We're able to pass these videos out. Like, we got to see a bunch of kids that were released from the daycare from Discovery Channel, led across the street to McDonald's.
Get them out of the scene.
And there were pictures of that coming out. So we were able to say, look, the kids are out.
Does that give you confidence that in an era of crowdsourcing, we're going to end up with fuller pictures of what's going on? I mean, after all, you can assign a reporter or two or three or four if it's a big, big, big story. But here you can have 40 or 400 people who are offering information.
Exactly. And that's why crowdsourcing is so important because, you know, in a lot of places, news staffs are smaller than they've ever been. And, you know, we really still want to be able to cover news, but it's very hard when you don't have as many eyes and ears on the street as we used to. And that's sort of where the crowd can really help fill in, whether it's giving tips, whether it's giving feedback on things that we want to know what's happening in your neighborhood, tell us about this. And that's something we've been doing for a long time. It used to be just, you know, putting a little thing at the end of your newscast or putting a blurb in the paper. Tell us what's happening in your neighborhood.
Right.
Now it's just at a larger scale and a lot faster.
Let's hear from our listeners. David in Medfield, Massachusetts is calling. Hi, David. Thanks. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I last year did a plan for NPR member stations under a contract with NPR for what I call emergent journalism in disasters, which is my field of expertise.
Okay.
And I couldn't agree more that one of the things that's terribly important is that you need to have a real dialogue on a continuing basis with the listeners or readers, because you're not going to have any credibility, nor are they going to know what to do when an emergency comes up if you haven't done that. Not all of us have had masters in journalism.
But how do you do that, David? I mean, after all, the disaster doesn't come until it comes. When the tornado is plowing through a state or a region, you're going to be very hungry to have input from listeners who are witnessing it firsthand, but they're not likely to spend a lot of time taking instruction for you in the calm, sunny days before that.
Well, you know, it's funny. I think that you can actually get around that by doing things like meetups and bringing in, you know, which is, in the case of public radio, a great way of involving your listeners and trying to leverage more contributions from them. But start that kind of dialogue. You know, you're definitely going to have some people who are only going to react in a disaster, but you're going to have other people who are, you know, devoted listeners and have a fair sense of the kind of information that you're looking for, that where you can create that dialogue in advance. And it's a real emphasis in this work that I do is on this emergent behavior phenomenon that was mentioned, that was alluded to, I think, by one of your
What are you talking, the sort of minority report idea that you can see events coming just by gathering circumstances?
That's very much a part of it, just seeing the trends on the tweets and things of that sort that can help you. But in addition, the other thing that's happening, it's not just the sum of the tweets. It's there when you bring in the social media, mm-hmm. you get a dialogue between the other listeners where, for example, as they said, that some of the information was corrected by the listeners themselves.
Kind of self-correcting system there. I mean, that's a tremendous idea if you can sort of harness and get a strong enough handle on this very diverse information flow that you've got coming. Derek Ashong, what about this idea? It's really interesting from David of sort of prepping the crowd, the public. I mean, we're talking billions of people on the planet, but can you begin on a wide scale when everybody knows that they're armed with a cell phone or whatever they've got? Can you build in the expectation that news organs will be looking out and seeking that? Can you build a kind of, I don't know, journalistically trained populace that's ready to fill that role? Derek, do you have to?
Well, a wonderful question. I think that you don't do it on a wide scale. You actually do it on a small scale, and it spreads. What you do is you build a relationship with your audience, and that audience then starts to know what is expected and what kind of ideas and the ways in which they can share them will most likely get them to be aired. I just got a tweet coming in from someone who's listening right now who says, while accountability is a legit concern, it shouldn't be used to marginalize crowdsourcing. And that is at W. Kwame on Twitter. And the thing that I love about this point is that accountability is always a concern. I remember when we had the Gabrielle Giffords shooting and there was a report that she was actually dead, and then it was retracted later on and it was like, no, she's shot in the head but she's in critical condition. You know, this is a major mistake, but we moved on. Then a couple of weeks ago we had another web outlet called What's Trending that was sponsored by CBS. They also made a mistake. They called that Steve Jobs was dead, and fortunately that was not correct, and they suffered the consequences from it. But what I think starts to happen is if you build a relationship with your audience whereby they know what is expected of them, the actual level of reporting is going to go up among key audience members, just as journalists keep each other accountable for the level of reporting that we do. So whereas I think that the issue of accountability is important, I just in our experience on the stream, it's shocking at how we've literally seen a transformation among certain sectors of our viewership based upon the expectations we set, and we see them getting better and better at reporting their own stories, which does make our job easier.
Robert Hernandez, I mean, people in our listening audience are keying in very quickly on the idea that the crowdsource can keep you honest. Robert writes on Facebook that they can be a break on spinmeisters, right? You can spin, you can pundit, can say anything, but if you've got a lot of real people living in the real world responding with their direct observation, it's harder to do that. Can give alternative views of the same events, Robert writes. But here's John at the website saying, you know, pointing out that individuals can be biased, so perhaps can crowds. John says, I'm sure Twitter will provide lots of thoughtful analysis. The crowd, then he writes, maybe a little cynically, overlooked the violence of the Egyptian protesters. Now, I don't know the fact there one way or the other, but, you know, he's saying, well, even hundreds or thousands of people can be biased in the way they report an event.
Sure, but I'd like to point out the irony that we're in a live call-in show where we're crowdsourcing from phones, from Facebook, from tweets. Yes, anybody could be biased, and these voices are welcomed. I think crowdsourcing, the term of crowdsourcing, really is something great for journalism where we're actually genuinely engaging with our audience as to help us report, improve our journalism, distribute our journalism, create our journalism, vet our journalism. It's a really powerful thing, and across the board, there are wonderful examples of it being showcased.
It's not just crisis reporting, Mandy, is it? I mean, we've been talking about Syria and Iran, but the crowdsourcing can also apply to what's going on in your neighborhood. What do you see? I mean, in some instances online, people are actually sort of filling in the blanks for what's happening on the school sports calendar or, you know, get-togethers and potlucks and all the rest. Some things that used to be done by local newspapers when they had the staff to sort of take those phone calls and put that all together.
Exactly. I used to work at the Cincinnati Enquirer, and this was in 2007. They were letting citizen journalists and citizens in the community write their own stories about what was happening in their community. You know, we would vet those and put them online, and there were usually things just like that. Potlucks, church events, school plays, things that, you know, local reporters just don't get to anymore, but things that are still important to people in the community.
When it's not just potlucks and school plays, how do you keep this from being gamed? Journalists were traditionally responsible to their editor, let's say. I mean, you bring in false reporting, though God knows we've had it even at the highest levels of American reporting, but sooner or later, you're probably going to be caught and fired. This, you know, Christos writes here on Facebook, corporate-sponsored people will be wolves in sheep's clothing. The idea that this can and will be gamed by people who now have access and interest.
Well, and I think a lot of that gets back to what the caller, Robert, had said, is that when you really want to build a network of trusted sources, you get to know people. A really good example of this, one of my colleagues at the Huffington Post, Arthur Delaney, he writes extensively about the long-term unemployed, and he has built a network of people through crowdsourcing in his stories to say, tell me what's going on with you. And now he has people he can go to all the time who have stories, and he knows them. He relates to them, and they know him. So whether it's telling just their story or a new unemployment report comes out, he has a list of tons of sources that he can go to who have firsthand experience he can talk to. So it's building that trusting relationship.
Let's crowdsource a little more right here, right now. Sean in Sudbury, Massachusetts. Sean, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call. I was giving a call because one of the resources that my wife and I use online in our local area is the Patch network of news sources for local news. For instance, I live in Sudbury, Massachusetts, and I go to sudbury.patch.com to get local news and information,
right?
Including hurricane recovery info, which was very, very helpful over the last month. I was hoping to hear a bit more about that, perhaps from one of your people there that could talk about it.
Mandy, this brings us back to that local reporting and people diving in to contribute all kinds of information that makes the community work.
Exactly. And actually, my company works with Patch quite a bit on things like that, whether it's kind of the local news like disaster recovery, a lot on politics as well. So it's getting that local coverage, not just from reporters who live there, but also just from people who live there who want to contribute, who have information to share, and especially in a situation like that where they have resources to share and they know exactly what to do, they want to contribute that to the larger story to help their community.
Derek Ashong, do you see news organizations maximizing what they're doing with crowdsourcing these days? Are we harvesting the full opportunity here?
No, not yet. I think that, especially from the television broadcast perspective, I see a lot of news organizations paying something of a lip service to the integration of social media and the drawing of the crowd into what they do. And I don't think it's malicious. I think that a lot of times you have people who are accustomed to a certain way of news gathering, news dissemination, a certain way of thinking about the news. And then you have a whole other cadre of people that are engaged in something different. And what's happening is we're in the midst of a kind of merging of these communities. So when I look as a TV host at our show vis-a-vis comparable shows, I don't really see anyone doing quite the same thing, in the sense that you'll typically have TV people trying to figure out how to do something digital, whereas we actually have digital people working with TV people to figure out how to do something new. And that's fully interactive. And that's where I feel the opportunity is. If you give your audience the respect and the opportunity to even enhance their own game, so to speak, to uplift their capability of speaking in terms that you are able to disseminate, I think you build a new kind of relationship with that audience. And I feel like there's a great opportunity there, and I'm hoping to see a lot more news agencies take it more seriously.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, a special edition of On Point from the Online News Association conference going on in Boston this week. Robert Hernandez, Mandy Jenkins, Derek Ashong are with me, and we're looking at something right in the heart of online news. It is crowdsourcing and the future of news. Crowdsourcing, that is, lots and lots of people inputting what they see and know and hear in many different ways, becoming part of the news stream. Crowds and crowdsourcing, a big deal in Egypt's Tahrir Square in February, chanting here what would become the refrain of the Arab Spring, "The people demand the fall of the regime." Here it is, captured by one demonstrator's cell phone camera. Talk about powerful, and out it went to the world, not from a reporter, just somebody right there with a cell phone. Then in July, riots spread across the United Kingdom as police tried to restore order. Amateur videos flooded onto the web. Here, police officers arrest a man, while a camera-wielding demonstrator looks on.
Why is he being arrested?
Why are they taking this person away?
Why is he being arrested?
Why are
they taking him? Why is he being arrested, sir? Why is he being arrested?
Stop the gate! Stop the gate! Hey, don't run
over me! Get back now!
Okay, and there the crowdsourced news gatherer becomes part of the scene. And we've got a question online on just exactly this front. And Derek, I'll put this to you. Greg writes, now he puts it about San Francisco, but you could imagine this almost anywhere. Greg writes, about the shooting in San Francisco, how much responsibility for the event does the crowd have? From the audio, it sounded as if the crowd made the situation worse. Did Grant, this is the guy on the train platform who ultimately died, did Grant feel encouraged by the crowd to resist? Did you know the police feel in greater danger from a mob? Derek, it is a little different whether it's one reporter, you know, or a mob doing kind of the reporting. What about that in-the-moment influence of the crowd doing the sourcing?
I think that whether people had cell phone cameras or not, it's not going to necessarily change the police's perception of whether they are a mob or whether they are a living, breathing journalistic organism. In this particular instance, and I'm glad the question came up, if you were to watch the video, you would see that they had actually detained a number of young men. Some of them were standing up against the wall. Oscar Grant was lying on the ground. One police officer had his knee on his back. Actually, two were had him on the ground, and one stood up, removed his weapon, and shot at him. So whether the crowd was there or not, I don't know that they could have encouraged him to resist when he was already face down on the ground. And to come back to my initial point, you know, it's easy to think that this new phenomenon, okay, now people are capturing cameras, so that changes what's happening on the ground. And to some degree, it does. But what's also important to recognize is that these kinds of situations have been going on for time immemorial, where people feel that they've been victimized by the powers that be, whether it's the Mubarak regime or whether in that case it was the BART police. What's different now is that you don't just get the story from the perspective of those who have influence and the filtered through the news media. You actually get the story directly from the people who were there. And sometimes that means a different angle to the story, which then journalists have a responsibility to put together with what they're hearing from the powers that be and hopefully try to give us a clear perspective on what happened.
Robert Hernandez, I mean, that's interesting. Our writer, Greg, he looks at this and he says the job of a journalist is to remain neutral. On the other hand, we know how difficult that can be. And, you know, journalism's been a business, and many people have, you know, in many instances over a long time said, well, mainstream media can get too friendly with powers that be, or it can have an agenda in some other direction. But do you think that there's reason to believe that the crowd will be ultimately a more neutral or even objective observer cumulatively than the mainstream news business has been?
I think it will enhance it and improve it. It doesn't replace it, but it will keep it transparent. You can't, if you have not only hundreds of witnesses, but cell phones documenting what happened, you can't fabricate it. You can't spin it. And that's what's powerful about the crowd. While the previous comment was concerned about the crowd egging on someone to do something, by having a crowd there, it may keep officials, police departments to be more self-aware that they're on camera, whether it's a cell phone camera or a broadcast camera.
There's this question of the overall ultimate balance of what we're learning, but meanwhile, it just rolls on. Bob in McMinnville, Tennessee. Bob, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
What do you know, Bob?
Well, I'm a team leader for a volunteer group that's working on a search effort for Bob Norton. He's a missionary pilot in Venezuela, went missing in 2009. And the local Channel 12, CBS in Chattanooga, obviously want to cover the story, but they can't send resources down to Venezuela to film. So every time we go down, which our next trip is scheduled in October, we take video footage. When we come back, we meet with the CBS affiliates, and they go over all of our footage, and they interview us, and they put together a really nice continuing story about this search for Bob Norton.
So you're going out with a particular mission in mind. You're not happening upon news. You're searching for a pilot down in Venezuela trying to figure out where he may be. You're going doing the reporting directly and bringing it back. These days, I think, Mandy, the news business is probably more likely to use that than they would have been 10 or 15 years ago, because the whole news business is getting accustomed to using what people bring them.
Definitely. It's something I've really gotten to see firsthand just from my time being in journalism. It's kind of been when this has been expanding. Mm-hmm. And the trust that we're now putting into our readers is really amazing. I mean, at one time it was like, we're up here, readers are down here, we're going to tell you what we know. And I think a lot more journalists are seeing the value in having the news come up instead of just go down.
That hierarchy melting away. David in Chesapeake, Virginia. David, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
You know, I'm just listening to all of the different views and so forth. I think, my opinion, I mean, it's good to some aspect to kind of, you know, pull in all of the tweets and comments and videos that you know, that are captured directly or, you know, coming from the public. But one thing I see, you know, the media doing is they always kind of leave everyone in suspense. They report something that they say is news, but then they pop up with these questions after they've, you know, presented all this information and facts or whatever, and then they end it with just a real huge pondering question, leaving everybody just in suspense, but then they never come back to resolve it or take a stance to say, you know, okay, well, let's clear up the cloudy mess and let's get to the thick of the truth of it. And they don't seem to do that.
Is crowdsourcing going to make that better? Will crowdsourcing improve that problem on that problem, David, or make it worse?
No, I think it makes it worse because it just leaves more angles of opportunity for the media to just kind of leave everyone still hanging on what's going on. I mean, for instance, you know, in my opinion, I mean, and you see it every day. Why isn't the media really looking and searching and discovering the truth about an issue or something that they consider news, you know, and really digging to the root problem or cause and giving the public answers, you know, versus just raising a question? I mean, everybody has questions, but give us an answer.
I'm so glad you raised this.
That's a great
because
question.
I mean, Derek, you can see the possibility here, and I think we've all witnessed a bit of this already. When there is this giant torrent, this river of crowdsourced information out there, it's easy to just put your hook in it as a news organization, pull out interesting tidbits, put it on the air. They're very captivating. They're compelling. People will watch. That is different from setting out with a mission to put in the shoe leather, the time, the work, and really nail something down as a reporter, old school style, and say, here's what's going on. This isn't just a bunch of tidbits. What about that danger of just exploiting this as a cheap way to fill news minutes, Derek?
Well, that's what I mean by paying lip service to the power of these technologies. You can easily say, okay, well, we let people tweet us what they think, so we're crowdsourcing, we're engaged with the audience.
Mm-hmm.
But what the caller raised is the point of journalists, the community, the citizenry, needs journalists to dive deeper and to find answers. And what we're starting to observe is that if you actually build a substantive relationship with the audience, you can't get away with just saying, hey, well, this is what happened, and not interrogating it any further. You can't get away with having a pundit come with one view, another pundit come with another view, have them argue a lot of nonsense and let no one understand afterwards, because your audience is literally holding you accountable, not only to yourselves, but to each other. And what I think is the nature of the opportunity is if we're open to really understanding that the people who we report to are not simply peons, they're not simply viewers, they're not just listeners, they're not something that can simply be measured by Arbitron. They're people, they have ideas, they have visions, and they are in need of a valued service. If we're open to respecting them a little bit more, then I think we're going to be able to take their considerations more seriously. One of the chief ones, I think, right now being, does the news media do a good enough job of reporting on things that matter? And I think the jury is still out on that, but I think that there's lots of room for improvement, and perhaps our audience can be a part of that process.
Mandy Jenkins, this has been a criticism tossed at the Huffington Post in particular. It's an aggregator. It's an aggregator of pundits. It's an aggregator, maybe through your work of, you know, what's on the social forums, of crowdsourcing. Look, anybody, I'm not throwing stones, anybody can be vulnerable to this. But Arianna Huffington has taken this sort of head on in some of her comments. You know, you hear our caller. He's worried that this just becomes a substitute for the real shoe leather work of real good, deep, hard reporting. On the other hand, the news business doesn't always do that, even when it should. WT writes here on Facebook, the crowd can also be a check on mainstream sloppiness, even advocacy.
Definitely. And I think, you know, it's that journalists still definitely have to do their job. I mean, you know, we, like all news organizations, we have our reporters out hitting these beats. But we also find the community to be very important. It's a huge part of the Huffington Post in particular. You know, we want to get more information as much as we can that we can't just get through our reporters. Our reporters can talk to the official sources and a few people, but they also can tap into the crowd to find out what's actually happening with them. Like, just for instance, when that earthquake struck a few weeks ago back in D.C., we built this map where people could tell us exactly where they felt it. So it was interesting to know how far out did this go. This was within an hour of it happening. There were no solid reports yet, but we actually had people reporting onto the map all the way far into the Midwest, feeling that at that time, what they were doing, how they felt it, how strong it was.
It wasn't just indigestion.
Right.
Well, how do they know? How do they know?
Some of them had very interesting stories.
Yeah, I'm sure. Anne in Lancaster, Virginia. Anne, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
Hi.
Tom, there's something that is beginning to worry me a lot as I see more and more journalists and newspapers firing their staff. Virginia Pilot recently last week has announced that they would be covering less news because they've had to let a lot of people go. It's that I have now, I see a greater problem in the future of we turn over what society needs to serve its needs to technology only, but what happens is we're replacing people that used to do that. And every time something gets more technical, it seems more companies will be laying off job positions and the unemployment will be rising. And I think we're going to reach a point where we cannot sustain humanity because we cannot give them a job because everything is technology. And maybe when we were very, very upset, very thought it immoral when China limited their families to having one child only, they were looking ahead and saying, we cannot sustain the human population if we cannot give them a living job and a way to maintain themselves here on Earth.
And our time is short, but you put your finger, I mean, the digital era can pull the plug on all kinds of jobs. If everybody's a journalist, maybe nobody's a journalist, crowdsourcing, Derek, could become, in effect, outsourcing. Newspapers cut back and, you know, just let the citizenry present the news.
I think that is something, a danger that needs to be considered, but I don't think it's going to happen because the more the citizenry has a voice, the more resonant you're going to hear their demands for quality journalism. I think that to some degree, news agencies have gotten a buy when we speak to each other and the voices of our audiences are not necessarily amplified unless we choose to amplify them. Now we're in a situation where they can amplify themselves, they can amplify each other with or without our consent. So I think that you're actually going to start hearing more concern for the quality of journalism and higher demands for quality journalism and greater rewards for those that engage in it. And perhaps I'm a little bit optimistic, but the trend thus far has been to see much, much more salient critique from audiences of their news agencies. And I only see that expanding.
Let's hope it works that way. One more call, if I may. Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Justin. Justin, our time is short, but give it to us straight.
Hi, Tom. Listening to the conversation, and it's striking me very much as the concept of emergence.
much the way the human brain works, or ant colonies, that, you know, individually not much is going on, and you don't need much to be going on individually. But once you get a large group together, a critical mass, then you're going to be producing something of value and of worth. And I'm curious how your guests feel that that may happen here, as opposed to in our political system, where a lot of people look at that and say, you get a lot of smart people together making very stupid decisions as a group. So I'm curious about how they see that this would work out differently.
Is our collective intelligence greater when crowdsourcing goes to work on it through the news? Robert, what do you say?
Wow, it's a great question. It comes down to, for me, the news consumer needs to be quite sophisticated, as the journalists need to. You know, the core of journalism, to verify, to consider the source, that old saying, still very much is in play. And we have to be protective and hold anyone who creates journalism, whether it be a byline or a tweet, accountable. And how we do that?
Hard to do that when it's one of a million out there. Derek, are we collectively smarter through crowdsourcing than we are any other way?
I think we can be if we do it right.
Agreed. If we do it right, we're going to have, I guess, decades in front of us now of deciding exactly what that means. It's going to be fascinating as that unfolds. Are there sort of guidelines out there, Mandy, or is everybody just kind of playing this as it comes at them?
I mean, there are guidelines that are, I mean, of course, obviously journalists have our own code of ethics that we all follow, hopefully. But I think that it is something where it's going to be developing over time, where the audience is learning from journalists, journalists are learning from the audience, and we're going to figure out how to hammer out those guidelines.
Evolving journalists right alongside 6 billion plus people on the planet, many of them becoming part of that crowdsourcing reality. I think we're glimpsing it, definitely not just the reality today, but a big chunk of the future here. Great questions raised in this hour, and we're grateful to each of you. Mandy Jenkins with the Huffington Post, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks.
And Robert Hernandez with the Annenberg School of Communication, USC. Thanks, Robert.
Thank you.
Derek Ashong with Al Jazeera, wonderful to have you.
Been a pleasure.
And thanks to the Online News Association for hosting us today here in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.